This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Critical accolades rained on Esperanza Spalding when she won Best New Artist Grammy this year. The award celebrated the young woman's considerable talents as a bassist and jazz vocalist. All right, well, one thing nobody said about Esperanza Spalding in 2011 is that she played pretty good for a girl. Now, that was not the case for countless female jazz musicians who came before her. For decades, women who performed jazz, especially instrumental jazz, endured an institutional sexism that valued them first for their looks and then for their musical talents, even if they sounded like Marianne Gaines. Filmmaker K.D. Ray has captured the stories of these generations of women in a new documentary called Lady Be Good, Instrumental Women in Jazz. The film screens today and tonight at Salem College in Winston-Salem at a special showing sponsored by the Piedmont Jazz Alliance. And K.D. Ray joins us now from the studios of WFDD on the campus of Wake Forest University to talk about the film. Kay, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Frank.
Tell us how you got interested in this.
I was living in Los Angeles, and some friends of mine, they said, well, my mother was Mary Osborne, the jazz guitarist. And I went, whoa, jazz, a woman playing jazz guitar. And they invited me over, and I saw this film footage of her being backed up by some of the jazz greats and Billie Holiday. She was backing up Billie Holiday. I went, why don't I know about this? You know, I studied jazz at the University of Washington, and she wasn't listed, so I started the film to be about Mary, and then it just snowballed from there. Every woman I met said, oh, well, you need to talk with so-and-so. They played with the Ina Ray Band, or they played with the Ada Leonard Band, or they played with the Coquettes in the 30s. And so every woman I met just kept saying, oh, you need to talk with this person. And the film just kept going for years.
So your film starts in the late 19th century when it had become commonplace for women to play at least the piano, right? Now, why was this the case? Why was the piano okay, but instruments like the sax and the trombone not so?
Well, you know, the women playing piano in the parlor was for home entertainment. It was accepted. But, you know, to get out and puff up your cheeks and blow a trumpet was just not accepted. And also the venues were kind of down and dirty. They're a bit seedy. And so these women, the early, like the piano players in New Orleans, like Sweet Emma Barrett and Jeanette Savant Kimball and Lil Hardin Armstrong, you know, they were playing in some pretty divey places besides the riverboats.
So the piano is this the site of domestic tranquility. You can have that. That's your domain. Slowly, though, that did begin to change, and you point out with the rise of family bands. Now, tell us about some of the stories you found in family bands.
Well, that was another way women learned to play different instruments outside of, you know, the parlor and the piano. Some of the family bands just decided to start performing for their neighborhoods or, you know, tour around the state of Indiana. And so that gave women the experience to learn numerous instruments, and it was accepted as a family band. And then later on, some of those same women took it out on the road and created their own bands in the 30s.
And, of course, those family bands are probably playing in more savory venues.
Exactly. You know, community centers, gazebos out in the parks. Yeah, very, very much more accepted.
So, but they're picking it up, and people are getting used to seeing women playing instruments other than the piano and other than just only vocals. And one of the women that you talk about actually came to Mary Louie Armstrong. Lil Armstrong was a piano player herself. Let's listen. So, okay, Lil Armstrong playing piano, but then there's May Barnes on drums. Tell us a little bit about them.
Right. Well, I think they played together later, but if you see their faces when they're playing, there's just this joy, and they are having such fun. They're like, if you hear it in the background, they are just laughing through that whole song. And May Barnes was also a great vocalist, but in this clip, she was actually just playing a snare drum behind Lil.
And what about Lil Armstrong? Why have we heard so little about her?
Yeah, it's a good question. it's a really good question. Why these women have been written out of history is beyond me. I didn't do this film to say, oh, let's tack this history onto jazz history. It's, I want people to just really be aware that women were playing all along from the 20s. They were there. Some were playing in men's bands. They were incorporated in men's bands. They created the all-women bands as a viable working alternative for women musicians. They were there teaching. And so it was incorporated, and it needs to be incorporated into the history, in the history books. And it's been kind of written out of history, like Lil Hardin Armstrong.
How did a woman make her way into a men's band? I mean, was it because she was just that good? Was it by accident? A guy dropped out and they threw her a horn? And how did it all happen?
Mostly they had to be really good and prove themselves over and over again. I mean, the story about Mary Osborne walking in for an audition, and some guys, and she was just this very petite thing, and pulls out this, you know, Gibson hollow body guitar, this huge, huge guitar, and guys started walking off the bandstand thinking it was such a huge joke until she started playing, and they went, oh, wow, this woman's good. So, and I heard that story over and over again with a lot of the women who did end up playing in some of the men bands.
And tell us more about Mary Osborne.
Mary Osborne. Well, she had a radio show in New York for years and years and years after she was touring with the big band. So she had a huge recording career, and you know, after she had her family, she had a huge recording career that went on for decades.
That would have been an extraordinary. That is the most extraordinary jazz pianist or instrumentalist in history. So we've got these women who are playing. To what extent were they, in a sense, novelty acts when they were booked into a place?
Well, a lot of them were considered. In fact, there's a chapter in the film called "Gotta Have a Gimmick," and the women address that issue. That, you know, they looked first and listened second. So in the 20s, there was a group, Babe Egan and her Hollywood Redheads, and they had to audition and show their legs as they audition, and they had to dance besides playing their instruments. And the women who didn't look quite right, they were kicked off the bandstand. And that really is pervasive through the 30s, you know, women really had to look good. But some of the bands, if you listen in the background, some of them are playing some pretty hot jazz, like the clip you played of Ina Ray Hutton's band with Marion Ganji on guitar. You know, some of those women were just really, really hitting it.
So you've got these good musicians, but you have club owners, essentially, who are looking at their legs. And what about the redheads? They had to dye their hair, right? Or some of them did.
Exactly. They, you know, all had their little haircuts, or they wore wigs. So it really was gimmicky, from the costumes, you know, wearing sailor outfits, you know, having, even up into the 50s, some of these women, when product placement and product endorsements started coming into the picture for the TV shows, some of these women had to, like, dye their hair with this hairspray. Each woman had to wear a different hairspray color on television.
Because, so okay, you know, nobody asked to see Louis Armstrong's legs.
Exactly, and he never had to dye his hair.
No. So, but were there bands then, I mean, could they be hired sound unheard just based on their looks?
Right. There was one group, Peg Gilbert's group, and Peggy, she died, I think, at 98, just a few years ago, and she was still going strong in Los Angeles up until she died. She had a group where they were hired sight unseen to go and play in a club in Hawaii. She thought it was a club in Hawaii, a jazz club, and they get on the ferry, and the guy says, no, you're playing for the circus. And so sight unseen, they had to go do that, and then they had to play for the circus, and in between they were able to do their jazz act.
Yeah, but some of them were very good. I think Hollywood Redheads were among those who actually were able to tour Europe.
Yeah, they toured Europe, and this is in the 20s. They toured Europe for 9 months and played for the King of Spain and at the Kit Kat Club and in Prague and Budapest, and they actually were asked to make a film. They were the background instrumentalist in this German film called Die Nacht gehört uns, which means the night belongs to us. And I was able to track that down in the Berlin Film Archives. And they also did the incidental music throughout the film. So we actually can hear, it's like one of the few records of hearing the women play in the 20s. Because there are just so few recordings of these women. There are few film clips of these women. So it was really exciting to find that and uncover that treasure.
And did most of them, if they wanted to play, have to play in all-female bands?
No, they didn't. And some women musicians actually said, I don't ever want to play in an all-women band because of the stigma attached that, you know, they were a lower class of performer. But I think, you know, history, I think, proves that different. Because, again, it gave women a viable working alternative as a musician, where if they weren't accepted in the men's band, you know, they could tour for, you know, and have a pretty solid job.
Who did they learn from? Were they learning from each other? Or were they learning from men?
Learning from each other, learning from the families, learning from each other. And, you know, the ones that went and played with the men's bands, you know, with Earl Hines or Quincy Jones bands. Yeah, they were learning from the...
Who are some of the standouts who actually played in the men's bands?
Melba Liston, great trombone player, played with Quincy Jones band. And also Patty Bowne, who's still living in New York. She played with Quincy's band. Lucille Dixon played bass with Earl Hines. There was a drummer, Marion Gant, Dottie Dogen, who still lives in Carmel, and she used to play with Benny Goodman, played drums with Benny Goodman. So,
and as far as the all women bands, how many were there? What you know, percentage of the jazz world did they make up?
They you know, they really began in the 20s, kind of gimmicky, again wearing the little costumes, little outfits, and touring around. Then they continued in the 30s, but during the war years and the USO circuit, there were over 100 women big bands. I mean, those numbers really ask you to readdress the history.
Wow, yeah.
Because, I mean, that you multiply that by, you know, 16, 18 women in a group touring the country and also in some of the war zones. I mean, those numbers, I think, beg to be looked at.
Right. Well, one of those bands was the Coquettes. Let's listen. So they could drum. That's the Coquettes. Tell us about them.
Well, I interviewed Vi Smith, who was the drummer in that group, and she's still living in New York also. And the Coquettes were a really active band in the 30s, and they were a corporation themselves, and they all voted on every issue that came up, where they're going to play. I don't know what they voted on the scores that they were playing to, but it was a viable alternative. And she said they played all the time. They had to schedule in vacations because they were playing all the time. But Vi, she played, I think, on the top of one of the buildings in New York as the featured drummer. You know, come and hear Vi Wilson play at the Starlight Room, I think it was.
Workers who have a say in their own conditions, they were communists. That's why we haven't told their story. That's the problem.
All women are communists.
All women are communists. Don't tell their story. Are you surprised that, I mean, it is a phenomenon, and it does strike me that someone would have at least noticed this with their sheer numbers and the quality, the talent, that they would not be, that there wouldn't be another documentary about them already.
Yeah, I was surprised. And in fact, I kept, one of the first things you learn in documentary film school is, like, if the story's been told, you have to have a really good reason to tell it again. So as I did interview after interview, then I raised some funding, you know, did some grants writing, and then went out and shot some more. And again, this was a part-time job for 15 some years. It was kind of a labor of love that I just kept going with. I kept thinking, I'm going to find that somebody has done this story because it's so huge. And, you know, year after year, nope, hadn't been done. So I now have a responsibility to these women to get this story out there.
One of the most captivating performers, I think, in the film was Ina Ray Hutton, who led her own band. Tell us a little about her.
Ina Ray was a musician and dancer in the early 30s and then began this all-girl band. And she was just extremely glamorous. They called her the Blonde Bombshell. And, you know, she wore this very slinky dresses and was up front. But she was a musician, so she really knew what she was doing. So she was up front, you know, playing the Blonde Bombshell, where you listen to the women in the background playing, and they're really playing some hot jazz. And some of these women, like Jane Sager, who played with her band, she's still living in California. I think she's about 98 now. And she's no longer playing, but some of these women were, you know, playing really some hot music.
What was it like for them on the road? Any of these groups or women, particular difficulties?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, when just traveling, I mean, you talk to any of the bands, the male bands, female bands, you know, the one night stands, you know, playing, getting off the bandstand, and traveling all night to the next gig. And but for women, there was an added element of, you know, having to put on your gown and fix your hair and your makeup and looking pretty to be on the bandstand.
Well, looking pretty and then having to sort of fend off whatever might come afterward with stage door Johnnies, et cetera. Was that a particular problem?
It was. I heard that story quite a few times. I didn't want to focus on it in the film because I really wanted to talk about the music. But yeah, women were, some guys thought they were easy targets when the all-women bands came to town. Or I think when the women were playing with the men's bands, once they were accepted, I think they had this protection of the other men in the bands. But with the all-women bands, sometimes, yeah, there's some good women coming to town. Let's go down and hear them and, you know.
What kind of treatment did they get in the press? Were they taken seriously by critics?
No. I mean, if you look at, like, the Downbeat articles from the 30s, they weren't taken very seriously. I mean, you look at the pictures that they show of Ada Leonard, you know, with her stockings sticking up in the air and her legs, you know. So, no, they didn't really take them that seriously. And then you also look at the African-American bands, like the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. They got some press, and they were actually did some Soundies films, but there were all these other African-American women's bands, like the Harlem Playgirls. They got some good press coverage in the South because, but there's no recordings of them. Hmm. There's no film footage of them. So they were really written out of history. So trying to dig up, you know, photos and some of their press books, it was a treasure hunt.
Were there any differences, black and white, between the two presses? The African American press, did they take women's bands more or less seriously than the white press? Or was there a difference at all?
You know, there was a difference if you look at the black press. They didn't show the sexy photos. And, you know, they just showed a photo of these women saying, hey, come to town. In North Texas, this group is playing. They seemed to take them a little more seriously than, you know, the Downbeat magazine writers.
And was racial integration any different for women than for men in the bands?
Definitely. You know, I think the International Sweethearts of Rhythm, I think they were integrated before even the Benny Goodman group started, you know, integrating. And, you know, they did have to be careful, both the white women who were in the band. I mean, there was a band of, you know, Chinese and Mexicans and African Americans and Caucasian women. And they had to be careful when they were touring in the South. The white women had to put on darker makeup. Some of them had to run out and catch a train because they were found to be integrated. And then, you know, the black women had to be careful where they had a drink of water or ate lunch or, you know. So they really had to, they faced integration long before the men's band or segregation.
Tell us about Anna Mae Wilburn. She's an African-American band leader.
Anna Mae Wilburn, she was the glamorous leader of the International Sweethearts of Rhythm. She was brought on after the first singer, again, to bring that glamour aspect to the front of the band. And she later on, even in the 40s, when, you know, men came back from the war, she started a combo. Women broke down and played in combos. And she continued playing, you know, until I think in the 60s, maybe.
You're a musician. How did your own experience as a musician fuel your admiration for these women?
Well, I grew up playing in classical. I played viola in orchestras and quartets, and also grew up singing and playing guitar, you know, all that. But I also grew up listening to my dad's jazz records. Just the respect I have for these women, getting out in the 1920s and 30s and, you know, getting out on the road and, you know, the hardships were pretty daunting, and I don't know whether I could have done it back then. But then talking to these women, you just get this excitement, and it's it makes me get excited too when I hear their stories. Going, oh man, that sounds like it would be really fun to be traveling with a bunch of crazy and talented women on the road. It sounds like it would, you know, I just admire them.
Kay, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kay D. Ray's documentary, Lady Be Good, Instrumental Women in Jazz, screens at 2 this afternoon, then again at 6 this evening at the Salem Fine Arts Center at Salem College in Winston-Salem. For more information, go to PiedmontJazzAlliance.com. Just ahead, a repeat performance by Yazara. Stay with us on The State of Things.